So good morning, everyone. Thank you, Joyce, for the intro. I have nothing to disclose. I am from the Liberty Mutual Research Institute for Safety. That's a pretty unfamiliar place for maybe many of you. Our mission is really to advance scientific, business-relevant knowledge in workplace and highway safety and work disability. We take ourselves focusing on the company motto to live safe, helping people live safe and more secure lives. And we're organized in four centers. I'm from the Center for Injury Epidemiology. Across the four centers, we seek to cover the gamut of primary to tertiary prevention and remediation control. And we publish everything we do in the open peer-reviewed press, as many of you do. So why bother about falls? This is data from the National Electronic Injury Surveillance System that basically shows that unintentional falls out of all unintentional injury causes treated in U.S. emergency departments, unintentional falls are clearly the front rank problem in every age group except for 15 to 24, and who knows, maybe they might bounce in, up into that category as well. If you're looking for comparison, by the way, for motor vehicle injuries, I'm going to get me an arrow here, there we go. That's basically down here, motor vehicle occupant, okay? So just for comparison purposes. So falls at work. Same level falls and slips and trips are a substantial injury burden in the global workplace, work we did earlier on about a decade ago. Same level falls have generally longer disability durations than other types of injuries. Slipping is a leading cause of same level falls, as established in the literature. So the talk today is really about, I'm going to take a study that we've done and talk to you about this issue around near misses, or moving kind of up the outcome chain, or redefining, if you will, something that may not have been thought of as an outcome previously as an outcome, as a way to more efficiently study a downstream outcome. So a near miss, defined here just briefly, is a potential injury-producing event. Hesman, Almgier, and Lowry and Bobble have done some early work suggesting that, hey, we might be able to use these things upstream as potential ways of looking at a problem. We could be more effective, more efficient in our studies, and actually come up with information that could be hard-hitting and not wait years and years and years for people to get injured, but look at something else. And obviously, near misses are already widely used in aviation process and healthcare industries for mishap prevention, so there's some precedent here in the science. Slipping is an important precursor to falling, but not every slip results in a fall or an injury. What we have here is a figure illustration from a book that we wrote a few years back, basically showing that, you know, this is a typical slip sequence, somebody basically walking along, they begin to get a foot slide. Somewhere in here, there's a kind of crisis point where they could recover their balance, and that doesn't necessarily mean they wouldn't be injured, but they could recover their balance and not fall. But generally, let's say somebody completes out to a fall, and so this is kind of the, if you will, the biomechanist view of how slipping happens. It's not always that clean or obvious. And we'll talk about that actually in a session tomorrow, what we found in a field study related to this question of how people fall. But so the question we asked ourselves is, well, could we use slipping as an upstream outcome measure? In other words, instead of using injury from falling or falling, could we use slipping? Basically, could we use slipping as an upstream outcome measure? And it would make it more feasible, as I said, to examine these factors for slip, trip, fall-related injuries. So we've looked at this in two studies so far. We have a third study actually running right now. But the first study is the one I'm going to focus on today. So why bother with restaurants? Well, about 1 million restaurants in the U.S. This is a little bit of an older estimate. It actually could have increased despite the downturn. Restaurants are one of the largest private sector employers with a substantial economic impact. About 10 million workers in limited service environment. It's about 3.5 million. So what's limited service environment? That's your burgers and fries types of places. Very similar floor plans, very similar processes across brands. So there's a lot of kind of stereotyping, if you will, of the exposure environment, which in a way is kind of an ideal experimental environment. You have a lot of control. So third in total count of injuries and illnesses for industries with 100,000 or more non-fatal cases after hospitals and schools. Same level falls are also the most frequent disabling injury event in restaurants. So they're the lead. Most places occupationally, overexertion injuries are the lead. In this case, in this industry, it's slipping and tripping and falling. So our prior work, the thing down in the corner there is a book we did from our Hopkinen conference in 2000. And the book, one of the things that we identified in the book was that there was a lack of knowledge about kind of engineering measures. People had done laboratory studies on tribology, you know, sort of objective friction-based measures of floor slipperiness. And people had done work on subjective measures, looking at how people perform in a laboratory environment. But nobody had ever looked at subjective and objective measures together in an actual work environment. You know, take it out of the lab and go, and there was a lot of lab evidence, but not anything in the field. And so we kind of set out to look at objective and subjective measures in the restaurant environment. And really what I'm going to talk to you about today kind of happened as a sort of happy accident. So borrowing from J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, it's a dangerous business, Frodo, going out your door. You step onto the road, and if you're not careful, if you don't keep your feet, there's no telling where you might be swept off to. And I think that's one of the fun things about being in science, or one of the exciting things about being in science, is the discovery aspect of the thing you didn't intend to find that you find that turns out to be a real game changer for you. And in this case, we started out very modestly with this. We wanted to get outcome information. The employers we were working with did not want to give us actual injury information, so we said, okay, what can we use as proxies? They were happy with us asking workers about injury, but we were only looking at a four-week retrospective recall. So how many injuries are really happening in a small population in 4 weeks? Not a whole lot. So we said, well, what if we asked about falls? Okay, that's a little bit better. Well, what if we asked about slipping? We said, slipping, what are we really going to get out of slipping? Is there going to be anything there? Is it going to be meaningful? Is it going to be useful? And we said, well, let's put it in anyways, and we'll get back to it later. So we went on and did our objective and subjective measure study, and you see some of the outcomes documented here from that work. And then we basically set about this question, getting back to the slipping data. Hey, there's little information about workers' typical experience of slipping in the literature in the actual workplace. So we specifically set out to look at individual and work environment factors that related to that. So the workers in this case were from a cross-sectional study in 10 limited service restaurants in the Northeast U.S. Participants completed written questionnaires in either English, Spanish, or Portuguese, which were the predominant languages of the work population. We asked about their occupational slip history in the prior 4 weeks at work, and also a number of important covariates and exposures. We looked at shoe condition, visible shoe contamination. We took photographic information. We did floor friction measures from the objective side of the study. And we want to mention that subjects were compensated for their participation in the study and was also IRB approved and reviewed. Methods from participants in the study, since they're all clustered within restaurants, were very likely correlated, so we chose to use a design that would deal with this problem. Logistic generalized estimating equations model with compound symmetry covariance structure. And that's the approach we used to look at both the univariate and multivariate associations. And so we had 125 employees in the survey, 87.5% response rate of the population we were able to access. Most of them were female, they were mostly young. Ethnicity was pretty balanced between whites and Hispanics. The mean location work experience was actually longer than we might have guessed at 35 months. Median 17, so it tends to be a shorter term employment population. And you see the work hours per week there. Then friction ranged from 0.42 to 0.81. So just a note about friction, normally goes from 0 to 1. 1 is the high friction side, 0 is the low friction, extremely low friction side. You can actually get values above 1, but that's a conversation for a room full of biomechanists and tribologists to have a fun time with, not us. So let's just say for this matter it's from 0 to 1. OSHA has a non-mandatory guideline that suggests 0.5 is some kind of, you know, magic value. It's actually, I think it's actually gone now, but it's such an industry-wide number because there was no other number that it was used very widely. And so you can see most of these sites have typical average friction values well over 0.5. So in terms of results at the univariate level, you see that about a third of this population was wearing slip-resistant shoes, which is a common intervention now in the industry. In our subsequent study that I'll talk very briefly about at the end, the population prevalence of this intervention had increased to about 66%. So it's actually growing over time. That study was about 4 years after this one, 3 years after this one. So that's a growing intervention, and we'll show you in results coming up that it was a pretty effective intervention in our second study. Sole wear, we looked at that aspect, how much the shoe sole had been worn down over time. Gross contamination, were there foodstuffs or other kinds of things in the footwear when we did the assessment. And then you can see about a third of the population actually reported slipping in the last 4 weeks at work. So we ran the multivariate analysis. This is looking at significant factors using the GE. You can see that restaurant mean coefficient of friction was significant. Male gender was significantly increased, and gross contamination significantly increased risk. And then age and hours worked were kind of marginal. And I'm going to talk about only the significant factors. For those that don't like staring at odds ratios, here's the same thing in prose. Just for a quick shot at that. And so in terms of COF, the average COF values, as I said here, were generally above the levels you typically see talked about in the literature. But 34% of the workers were still reporting slipping, despite the fact that these values in some cases were rather high. Higher restaurant COF was negatively associated with worker slip history. So basically what we're dealing with here is that the higher the COF, good news, the lower the slip frequency. So for each 0.1 change in the COF, the odds of slipping, in this case, the way we did the study, the odds of slipping decreased by 41%. So from the highest to the lowest friction restaurant, you got a reduction risk of sevenfold. So then results suggest that even modest improvements in COF could have a substantial impact on slipping in these environments. There are things out there like restoration of roughness type treatments you can do that don't require ripping out the entire floor. So there are ways to do this in terms of doing intervention. Gross contamination was obviously associated with a positive history as well. About 13% of the workers, just kind of natural frequency, we observed gross contamination. And that's an indication of a broader management problem in terms of how well the facility is doing in managing its floor contaminants, drop foodstuffs, process layouts. Are you having to transfer foodstuffs across walkways? Things like that. So management can play an important part in imparting safety and health housekeeping best practices, but also in the design aspects. And lastly, male gender was associated with increased odds of a positive slip history. Potential explanations include gender-based differences in required friction, which has been documented in the laboratory, risk-taking propensity, which we just talked about actually in the study presented first here, reporting, more likely one gender to report than another. But these would have to be explored in a larger study, and we've been doing some of that. So strengths and limitations, this was the first study in the literature demonstrating a strong association between measured COF and the worker experience of slipping in an active work environment. We measured friction on the limitation side, point in time, and slip history was recalled, so they aren't completely aligned with each other. Observed variables included classification of the footwear, slip resistant or not, were assessed visually, so we didn't have any absolute standard. There is no standard for slip resistant footwear, interestingly enough, although there's plenty of it out there labeled slip resistant. Number of factors were obtained from retrospective self-report, which could be subject to recall bias, as any retrospective design has to deal with. And so what we felt the study demonstrated, and we have this in the paper, it's in injury prevention actually, is that we've demonstrated that slipping occurs with sufficient frequency to allow the application of epidemiologic methods to assess exposure contributions. We confirmed this more recently in the second study. We got so excited about this finding that Santosh Varuma, my colleague, who actually has a whole session on falls tomorrow at the same time slot. If you're interested, you can see more on falls tomorrow morning at 8:30. He basically took off with this and designed his dissertation around it. We actually did a prospective cohort study using this as the outcome measure. And that's had some really exciting, just to quickly sum up here, a much bigger study, 36 sites, 7 states, almost 500 participants. We basically did an initial baseline assessment at the work site. Then the participants reported their slip experience weekly for the next 12 weeks. By web, phone, or mail. We collected person time data in this case so we could actually calculate rates. And so in terms of what we found, a little bit more conservative than the odds ratios, consistent with the present study finding, we observed strong associations between COF and the rate of reported slipping. So in this case, a 21% reduction in the rate for each 0.1 increase in COF. And slip resistance shoes were associated with a 54% reduction in the rate of slipping, which we thought was one of the big field goals of the study. For slips involving a fall under an injury, because we were skeptical, you know, what exactly is a slip in this case that we're getting reported, we actually looked at what we call major slips, which is 8% of all slips, 12% of participants. And COF was still protective. Slip resistant shoes trended protective, but were not significant. And so just to report, somebody else who's used this method, some colleagues in Israel have actually used this to do community dwelling seniors. About the same time frame that we were doing it. And so we're completing data now on a larger prospective study, now looking at full-service restaurants that have a much more diversified exposure. So if you will, we're getting out of the kitchen and into the rest of the floor where you have a lot of commingling with customer traffic. We are hoping to look at major slips in more detail in this particular case, those that actually lead to an injury or fall, so we can better understand the slip-fall-injury continuum. And longer term, we're also investigating the potential for wearable sensors to provide more objective outcome information. So we move away from self-report or evaluate how much self-report aligns with actual biometric measures that you can actually do. And we're getting closer to that, but it's not. There are a lot of people working on that problem of wearable sensors, but slipping is a kind of noisy phenomenon. Some people have tried to look at it in the past in lab. You know, a slip looks a lot like a move your hand, looks a lot like a cough. There are a lot of things that sensors pick up, and defining the profile is not straightforward. So it's not like a just instant solution type problem. But we are working on it and looking for other people who are working on it to work with us on it. And so the key references for the study are right here. As I said, this work I just talked about more extensively is in injury prevention. And then one of the first papers, but not the only paper, certainly from the prospective cohort study, which Santosh presented in Denver actually a couple years ago, and actually had a poster on last year and this year, was in occupational environmental medicine. Most of our papers on that study have been in OEM. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions, and I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you. Yes?
Really good, and particularly I'm just amazed that Liberty Mutual has this album, because I think I have Liberty Mutual as my insurance carrier. Have no financial connection.
I was going to say, you have nothing to disclose, right?
Now, you mentioned the fact that there's a recall, potential recall bias in the reporting, but my question, too, is that I don't know about the environment in a restaurant, but wouldn't there be a social desirable response to say that you would report fewer falls and more falls?
Yes, it's so the question is there kind of a social desirability not to say the environment is slippery? We did actually in this earlier study, we didn't have, the data were not as high quality for slipping, but we actually did that study in two arms. One arm was here in the U.S., that's the arm I reported. The other arm was in Taiwan. And in Taiwan, we had some really interesting challenges with getting workers to report, because exactly the problem you were talking about was really profound there. More group orientation, honor the leader, so you don't want to ever say anything. And so we actually had to work to culturally adapt the instruments in the study so that it would be parallel between the U.S. and Taiwan, so that we'd actually get information from, so they wouldn't just say everything's fine, because that was kind of the natural tendency. So the study design was kind of, aligned to do that in the end, so we made some changes. We did a pretest and did some changes in it, in a pilot. And it's a good question. We haven't found, I don't think, a problem with that. Really looking across the studies, there's a question about whether primary language might be an influencer, and in fact, some of the things we found in the subsequent studies is that, for example, whites and Hispanics have the same rates of utilization of slippers and footwear, which is actually Santosh's poster from this week. So we're not seeing that there seems to be a bias along those lines. What's kind of nice about this is we're finding kind of the same thing. So what we found in the cross-sectional study in 2002-ish, 2003-ish, we found again in very robust fashion in 2007 through 9. And we're kind of seeing similar effects. So it seems to be a pretty stable element, and something that workers don't feel too spooked about, because they're not really talking so much about injury. And they're also doing this offline. So they're not standing in front of their employer saying, I had an injury, or I'm going to report an injury to the employer. They're telling us by phone or by web. Web's more popular than phone, actually, and much more popular than written questionnaire. But sorry, that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but hopefully tackled it. Yes?
I wonder if you've ever looked at whether you can increase friction in shoes too much, where people are now walking in a way that is totally unadapted to them and therefore causes them to fall, and what is the maximum amount of friction that would be ideal?
That wasn't something that we looked at in this study. I can tell you there is such a thing as having too much friction. There's also a question we did look at in our healthcare worker study around transitions. So you go from carpet to smooth floor, or the reverse. And you get sort of these effects that are a lot like coming off a moving system. Like if you're at the airport and you're on one of these people, carriers, and you're standing or you're walking, and all of a sudden you hit the regular floor that's not moving, right? You have a sudden rate change, and it kind of trips you up. Same kind of a thing, but in a different mechanism, can happen when you're transitioning from smooth or from high friction to low friction, or low friction to high friction. You can get a sort of, a really high friction can be a trip hazard if it actually obstructs, or if there's slight variations in the floor surface, you see people catch their feet. We have not got at this point any lab science on what's too high friction. There's maybe a little bit out there on the literature on it, because most of the focus has been on trying to improve low friction, because that's really the much more widespread problem, environmental contaminants, meteorologic contaminants, things like that. So that's what most people are trying to fight. But it is a good question. And We did actually get BMI, and BMI was controlled for in the analysis. It didn't seem to suggest anything. Yes, Dave.
Studies. But I have a question about slips versus trips. Now, there is a distinction, right? And was that, because sometimes, every once in a while you say trip, you almost always just saying slip. Was this really just about slips only, or was it about also trips over, and did the workers understand?
Yes, we didn't find a problem with that. So we've actually done two major study arms, one with NIOSH and healthcare workers, and this one in restaurants that we've been pursuing, some of which was done with Harvard. And these basically have been fascinating in the sense that we basically stopped to look at slipping because we're interested in tribology factors. So we're looking at subjective measures of slipperiness. So, and slipping was a more important outcome. We've actually, in the full service study, we're actually asking about tripping as well. We don't think workers were confused about the difference. Tripping is a pretty significantly different thing. Although, in the healthcare worker study, we're asked about all of this stuff. We actually had a lot of people that reported they slipped and tripped. I mean, I say a lot, you know, it might have been 5%. It wasn't very common, but it was common enough that we did get that kind of response. So there are cases where people will do both or think they've done both. And what we're really excited about, I'm going to talk about tomorrow, and another thing that's going head-to-head with Santosh's session, I'm not in Santosh's session, is actually that in OHS section, is that the exciting thing, I think, is that people can tell you a lot about what actually happened when they slipped and fell at a pretty good, you know, like, we in some cases interviewed people 2-3 weeks later, and they were actually telling us about things, and we thought, there's no way this is possibly going to have any kind of, you know, there's no way people can answer a question that's essentially something you would observe with a camera in a biomechanics lab, and we're asking them, like, heel strike, toe off. And interestingly enough, they really did a brilliant job with it. And we're shocked that people can recall that much detail about foot position and things like that. And it looks, I mean, but there's definitely statistical evidence, I'll show tomorrow, that it actually is meaningful. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of value that can be extracted from this. And the kind of cool part about this is this kind of gets to scalability of an efficiency of design and ability to look at risks. You know, slipping and falling is kind of a problem unique to this where you can actually start walking back up this chain very obviously. But there may be other areas we can apply it in as well. So,
thank you. One more question.
Yeah, in the back.
I'm curious about the rationale or why a four-week window was selected for slip history. It seems like the environment could change quite a bit in a four-week period.
Yeah, we took the four-week period, I think, because we were trying to get at a compromise between, if we asked 1 year, I mean, there's a lot of work with the HIS, for example, that shows if you ask 1 year versus 3 months versus, you know, the further out you go, the less recall you get, basically, the less effective the recall is. So we were trying to strike a balance between a period we thought we'd get sufficient number of events because we didn't have any a priori data to go by, and then this issue of getting effective recall or lack of, sort of loss of recall. So that was really, there wasn't anything magic to the 4 weeks. And we also thought it was something that most people could, get their hands around to think about the last 4 weeks at work. So that was basically the reason we picked that. As I said, the prospective study moved on from that. So we're actually asking people over time as they experience the problem to report it. So it's a different paradigm. So thank you very much. Appreciate it, Tim.